You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CyberWire's Research Saturday. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is our weekly conversation with researchers and analysts tracking down threats and vulnerabilities and solving some of the hard problems of protecting ourselves in a rapidly evolving cyberspace. Thanks for joining us. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Well, I mean, the most interesting thing about this is obviously, like, steganography is not new. It's been used since the days of the Romans. It's been around for a long time, but typically you see it used with image files.
That's Eric Milam. He's VP of Threat Research and Intelligence at BlackBerry Cylance. The research we're discussing today is titled Malicious Payloads Hiding Beneath the Wave.
And in this specific case, it was very interesting to see it used with a different file format, in this specific case, a WAV audio file. So that really drew our attention right away and was something fairly interesting. There's not a lot of research out there. There are some discussions around it. I think some people have covered it, but not to the depth in which we wanted to go to within this research.
Let's start off with some basics here. I mean, I think most of us are probably at least somewhat familiar with what a WAV file is. That's an audio file. It goes back a long way. It's a file format that's been around a long time.
Yeah. It's it definitely predates the MP3s and MP4s that we have these days. It's been around since the beginning of time. Yeah, it's very interesting. I think the reason it was chosen, or what we've come to believe is the reason it was chosen, is back then when this was created, there wasn't a lot of file integrity checking going on. And so when you do something like Stego, you have to really understand the format so you don't break it, right? Some file formats are definitely a lot more forgiving. That's why, you know, Stego in images, is they normally use PNG. Lack of integrity checking, just the ease of leveraging that format. Same thing here with WAV. If they tried to do this, say, within an MP3, there's file integrity checking, there's compression, there's all other kinds of things that have to go into it that could potentially break. So I think they kind of took the path of least resistance in picking the WAV file itself. And I think the file format really helped them, you know, make it a little bit easier on them.
Yeah, that's really an interesting insight. Well, let's go through here together. How exactly did this work? It wasn't just the WAV file standing on its own.
Yeah, that's correct. Like, every WAV file was coupled with a matching loader file. So the way it works is the loader file is paired with this item, with this file. And when it runs, essentially, the loader then will look for that WAV file, grab and extract the items out of it, parse that into memory, into the same address space, and then execute the malicious payload that's within it.
And what's going on within the WAV file itself? Or are they spreading the useful data throughout the file?
Yeah, there's a certain level of encoding that happens, obfuscation within that. I have to admit, I don't know the technical details around that part. So essentially, yeah, what they're doing is they're leveraging empty space or areas within that file format in order to put these malicious bits in there that can then be extracted. And the interesting thing was, as I was pointing to earlier, they didn't actually break the file format. The WAV files actually played, one played music and one played white noise. So that means they had a really good understanding of where they could put things, the file structure itself, and how they could leverage and get the items back out of it.
Yeah, and again, very similar to what we've heard about folks doing with image files, where if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't know that there was anything wrong with the file at all.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, we did some research around APT32 and Ocean Lotus not that long ago, where they used PNG files and they used encoding within the RGB to hide a payload and be able to extract a payload. So similar technique, just a different file format.
Well, there were three basic categories that you all cover here in the research. Why don't we go through those together one by one?
Sure.
So the first one employed some steganography to decode and execute a file. What was going on with that one? A PE loader?
Yeah. So the PE loader, the way it works, that goes back to what we're talking about with the coupled file. So there's essentially two different files that were placed on these systems. So the first one is a PE file, which we'll call the loader, which knows how to access the WAV file, the specific WAV file, and extract what needs to be extracted from that in order to either install the backdoor, or in another instance, we were able to find some crypto mining software as well. So we had both shellcode and crypto mining. So that loader would be matched with the WAV file. So those two both exist then on the endpoint. And when that loader is run, it's able to grab that WAV file again and extract that shellcode into memory and then provide access back to the command and control server for, you know, additional nefarious activities.
It would seem to me like the loader itself could be the thing that kind of gives away the game. A WAV file gets through unnoticed, hey, what's this loader, or what's this mysterious file here doing on my system that turns out to be the loader?
Sure. And potentially those are the ways where a lot of things get caught, right? So the difference being that the loader is a portable executable in this case, and the WAV file is, you know, as we talked about in the research, a benign file that you would never expect to have any malicious intent behind it. So when you look at things like the loader, there's different things associated with it, different characteristics. Obviously, if it's something that's never been seen before, unless you're using something like machine learning, you might not ever detect it. So The way in which we look at files that could potentially be benign, if you think about a loader, a lot of times those are largely written to bypass any level of security. They're very kind of simplistic in which they just go out and download or pull down additional information. In this case, the loader was simply meant to read another file. So there might not really be, at first glance or first blush, any specific malicious intent or anything that might be found around that. So what we tend to do in those types of situations within BlackBerry Cylance is we leverage a technical technique using machine learning that is referenced as centroids. It's a technical term around basically just really building a specific model for catching items. So we're able to do something like build a specific model around this loader that even if potentially it's not deemed malicious, we're able to actually still find it, catch it, analyze it. And what that also allows us to do is as these attackers evolve these techniques, change these loaders, if the variance isn't too great, we can continue to catch those as they even adjust and evolve.
Now, do the two files typically show up on your system at the same time? Is there any attempt to put a time gap between the installation of the two, or does that not really matter in this case?
No, it doesn't necessarily matter in this case. The only thing that matters is, again, they're a matched pair, the loader and the WAV file. So they both have to be on the system for this to happen. You can't have one loader with a different WAV file. They're really dependent on each other. So yeah, they tend to be downloaded simultaneously. We didn't experience anything, at least in what we were able to analyze, where say it was something that was UPX packed or packed in some way that then ended up on the system and was, you know, extracted for the two. The way we analyzed it pointed to the fact that there was probably some type of backdoor connection to the command and control server, and then those files were then downloaded simultaneously.
I see. Now, the second category of loader was using an algorithm to hide some shellcode. What was going on with that one?
The attackers are using the Metasploit framework shellcode. And so obviously when you're using shellcode, the goal is to maintain a connection to keep your backdoor going, your command and control responses and execution. And so this is how these attackers were able to stay on these systems for a really long time. I think the main thing too that I want to point out is like when you use something like a backdoor, you're obviously targeting. And when you couple that with something like hiding this within a WAV file, like the main focus is trying to stay as hidden for as long as possible. So they definitely believe that this is an adversary that is really looking to stay inside an environment, exfil as much data as they can, and continue to move throughout the environment.
And then the third one was using an algorithm to hide some PE files.
Yeah, there was like a crypto miner that was being used, Monero crypto miner, which we had some conversations around this. It's easy to say that, okay, since it's a crypto miner, they're probably using this to just go do some mining, make some money. Maybe they've exfilled everything they need from a system, or maybe they've identified a system and they just want to make some easy cash. But the other side of that too is possibly that these attackers want to fire off red herrings in other areas of the organization. So that the focus ends up happening on that. So if, let's say they use something that's a crypto miner that might be more easily recognized or more easily caught or identified quickly. And let's say they're using that in a completely different part of the organization in which they're actually attacking and exfilling data. It's an attempt to move the attention of the SOC and other individuals to that and to addressing that. So we're kind of torn between those two, but definitely interesting for sure.
Yeah. Any patterns that you're seeing in terms of who this seems to be focused at, both in terms of groups and geographically?
We looked at that. They're definitely not targeting an individual. If they're going to spend the amount of time they did here to hide and obfuscate, again, using a WAV file, something that no one would ever think is malicious. They really put a lot of thought into this. They wanted to stay hidden as long as they could, which really means that they're targeting enterprises and organizations. We haven't seen a trend at this point as to specifically, you know, a vertical like healthcare or auto industry, but we're definitely keeping an eye on them to see, you know, where they end up going from here.
And in terms of detection and protecting yourself against this, what are your recommendations there?
Since this payload is, you know, it's loaded into memory, so it's really only detectable in that space. You know, it's easy to understand or to analyze a system that's being crypto mined by some of the things that are happening on it. Most easily, usually the CPU or GPU is maxed out for a consistent amount of time, but that's dealing with the symptoms of it. So in order to really handle this specific attack, you'd have to have something that is looking in the memory space, understands what's going on in that memory space, and is able to make a decision or a determination or to take preventative steps from analyzing what's going on in that memory space.
It's really a fascinating dilemma in my mind, in that, you know, you have these legacy files that have been around for decades, these mm-hmm. legacy file formats. Mm-hmm. And I think we sort of categorize them in our minds as being completely benign, partly because they're sort of tried and true. Those of us in certain industries like podcasting, you know, we're slinging mm-hmm. around WAV files all day long and not thinking twice about it. Right. I wonder if it's time for a little bit of recalibration when it comes to how we think about these legacy files.
I mean, absolutely. Obviously, as time goes on, things get better, right? Things change. Again, like MP3 has been around also for a very long amount of time. You know, there's also OGG files. There's a whole bunch of different file formats that can be leveraged. And I definitely think that when we look at something that, you know, I hate to say is so old, because I'm probably just as old as it, but something that has been around, right? We don't think about security when it comes to these things, because they're just, as you mentioned, a normal part of every day. And haven't really been tied in the past to anything that would be malicious, right?
Right.
So I don't want to call it a wake-up call, but it's definitely something where you look at that and go, wow, yeah, maybe I should put up a little bit more, be a little bit more concerned around some of these, right? And just maybe use a little bit more operational security per se when handling these.
Yeah, I mean, just as you said at the outset, just that these file formats internally don't have the type of integrity checking that we've come to expect from modern file formats. And perhaps the very fact that they operate in that way means that either they deserve a closer look, or even, you know, maybe it's time to, I don't know, recommend that these formats maybe get retired for something a little more modern.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree 100%. I mean, it's not like we don't have anything better out there, right?
Right.
I mean, getting rid of WAV files,
it's hard to imagine, right? Yeah, it's hard, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, and I don't know how widely they're still used and leveraged. You know, in my small world, it's all about compressed files. Because I remember back in the days of copying DVDs or ripping the DVDs, and it was a WAV file, and it was like ridiculously huge, right? For mm-hmm. back then, obviously. And then when MP3s came out, you're like, wait, it's a tenth of the size? Okay.
Right.
So that was back at least in the 90s. So mm-hmm. we're looking at 20 years. So maybe it is time to just be like, hey, we're not going to leverage that anymore.
The funny part of it is that in the interim, file storage capacity has become so crazy that it's real sort of meaningless that a large WAV file it's not really a barrier anymore.
Yeah,
In professional audio production, I mean, WAV is to this day is one of the industry standards because it's uncompressed, you know,
right.
And so ubiquitous. So yeah. What an interesting thing to have to think about.
Yeah, I mean, this research really does beg the question of the things we thought were safe. Now we have to, you know, we do have to put kind of an eye to and the things maybe, you know, we always say if you don't build something with security in it from the get-go, it's hard to strap security onto it afterwards, right? And mm-hmm. obviously this would fall into that realm, right? No, I don't think anybody ever considered that. And again, it's still fairly new to see this, but it begs the question as to, I mean, how long was maybe this going on before we actually identified it, right? Across the globe, across the population.
That's Eric Milam from BlackBerry Cylance. The research is titled Malicious Payloads Hiding Beneath the WAV. We'll have a link in the show notes. Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business. The CyberWire Research Saturday is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.